This episode is brought to you by StubHub. There's nothing better than seeing your favorite artists live in concert, and StubHub gets that. Explore your live style on the world's largest ticket marketplace, and stick around because a little later in the show, we're going to talk about our all-time favorite live events. Make sure you head on over to StubHub.com/pop to find your next concert ticket. Welcome to Switched On Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
So Nate, have you noticed this anxiety that has overtaken pop music in the last 6 months?
Which one? I feel like pop is full of anxiety.
So according to many, the economics of streaming is changing music so significantly right now that pop may literally never sound the same again. And today I want to investigate these claims by seeing how musicians are altering their sounds to make it in today's streaming economy. And to do this, I've recruited Aisha Hassan and Dan Kopf, who have written about how streaming is affecting the sound of pop for Quartz in a piece called The Reason Why Your Favorite Pop Songs Are Getting Shorter. Aisha and Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here.
This is exciting.
Yes.
It is.
Okay. So in a recent Guardian interview, mega pop producer Mark Ronson said that all your songs have to be under 3 minutes and 15 seconds because if people don't listen to them all the way to the end, they get into this ratio of non-complete heard, which sends your Spotify rating down and songwriters are forced to churn out hits at short order. So Aisha, can you untangle Ronson's gripe and explain what is causing so much concern?
So the way that many music streaming services work is that songs generate money per play. That means every time that they're streamed, they generate a certain amount of money, and that's very little. So it ranges between $0.004 to $0.008. And then if you don't play it to the very end and that rating goes down, meaning that people don't listen to the song through as much, then the song is less likely to make it into Spotify's really lucrative playlists, which get them streamed more. And because the amount of money is so little, volume is really important.
So this is obviously extremely different from how artists were paid in the past.
Right. I think it's important to note that artists right now, according to a report in 2017, they're only getting about 10% of the music industry's total revenue. Hmm. But streaming is so important because that's how they're going to break out, right? And if they're not going to be heard by audiences, then less people are going to buy their tickets for their concerts, less people are going to buy their merch. So to be visible, it's really important to sometimes game the streaming system so more people listen to their stuff.
Okay, gaming the streaming system. Yeah. So there's some sort of perverse incentives going on here. And just to sort of get a sort of order of magnitude around this, a CD used to cost, you know, $15 to $20.
Right.
And how many songs do you have to stream in order to make the equivalent on an old record?
So 1,000 streams is equivalent of $6. So we're talking about 1,500 streams to get $9.
Whoa. And, right. And of course, and the artist probably is only making a fraction of those $9.
That's exactly right. The music services tend to take 30% of that revenue. So Spotify or Apple Music or whatever will take around 30%. And then even though you've got the rest of that money going to artists, depending on the deal that they have with record labels and the amount of people who have contributed to the track, that money, which is already very little at the beginning, is split up even more. Hmm. So artists are actually getting a very, very small amount of money.
Okay, so this is interesting. I feel like we have two different issues at hand now that we have to deal with.
Hmm.
One, as you mentioned, is this question of are songs getting shorter and sort of why? And then also, are there certain like time markers or boundaries that you have to fit within? Is that changing the way that perhaps people are writing music? And so let's take them in that order.
Great.
So are songs getting shorter?
Yes, definitely. So around 2000, the median length of a Billboard Hot 100 songs was well over 4 minutes, so about 4 minutes and 7 seconds. And in 2018, it was just over 3.5 minutes. So we've lopped off more than 30 seconds off the average Billboard Hot 100 songs. So that's quite a bit.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark Ronson's anxiety that Charlie quoted at the beginning of this episode is perhaps warranted. Songs are getting shorter.
Yes. And there's also these extreme examples. So there are a bunch of songs now that are under 2.5 minutes long. So in the 2000s, there were virtually no songs under 2.5 minutes that made the charts. And in 2018, about 6% of them were less than 2.5 minutes, and some even just 2 minutes.
Yeah, you documented this in your piece, and there's like a hockey stick-like graph, basically starting in, I don't know, like
2015.
In 2015, all of a sudden, there's all of these songs that are now 2.5 minutes or shorter. You pointed to Kanye West and Lil Pump's I Love It, which comes in at just over 2 minutes.
Wow.
Correct.
So the question, of course, is like, where is the music going? I'm curious, in your investigations, how much of this do you see is intertwined with the dominance of hip-hop as the main form of today's popular music?
So that's a complicated thing to answer because, you know, hip-hop has seeped into all genres. So even when you listen to country, as you guys have pointed out in previous shows, country now has a hip-hop effect. But if you look at every genre, they've all fallen. R&B, rock, pop, country, all of them have taken a big dive over the last 2 decades. Rap the most, so it's definitely the biggest phenomenon there, but it's not just a hip-hop thing.
So on the one hand, we have some different incentive structures set up, and just to be clear about them, my understanding is we have songs are getting shorter because the way that you get paid with streaming is per song. And it used to be, since the I don't know, the age of album-oriented music, that the album was the main way that you made made your money. And so now, if you're getting paid per song, it makes sense to have like 20 really short songs that might actually run shorter than an album length that would be 10 songs that are twice, three times as long. And so you're gaming, can I get as many songs in as possible? Is that an accurate description of how some people are understanding this?
Yeah. I just want to complicate things a little bit. So, yes, we are pretty confident that streaming matters, but this is actually a pretty long-term trend. So if we look over the 20th century, you'll see that songs were quite short in the 40s and 50s, and then they got way longer through the latter half of the 20th century. And then starting around the late 1990s all the way up to today, we see songs shortening. So it's definitely got to be more than just streaming, but we're confident that sort of the effect that we're seeing over the last several years is a result of the desire to make more money from having shorter songs. And if somebody listens to an album repetitively, the artist will get more money. But there's definitely more going on there than just streaming.
Okay, so Spotify actually put out a press release about this phenomenon and said that in the world of digital consumption, our narrow windows of free time are the object of fierce competition by the seemingly limitless choices streaming platforms present. Short songs represent a solution to an audience's abundance of choice alongside endless opportunities for diversion. So there's sort of a question of like, are audiences also driving this? That perhaps that's what they're suggesting. I think what we need to do, though, is examine the music and see, is this really going on? And I'm particularly interested in looking at like, if songs are getting shorter, what's being put on the chopping block? And so we established that hip hop is the most dominant form of pop music right now. You go on the Billboard, 60-70% of the charts are going to be hip-hop. And if you also look at the songs which tend to be shorter, especially these sort of 2-minute, 2.5-minute songs, a lot of hip-hop songs in there as well. And I think there's a part of this which makes sense because in hip-hop, you don't necessarily have as rigid a structure of a pop song. You don't necessarily have to have, for example, a pre-chorus or a post-chorus or a bridge. You can just have hook, verse, hook, verse, and you're out. And so when you look at a song like Kanye West and Lil Pump's piece, they're doing exactly that.
When the first time they ask you, you want sparkling or still? Are you trying to act like you was drinking sparkling water before you came out here? You're such a bitch. I'm a sick folk. I like a quick folk. I'm a sick folk. I like.
Let's do a two-verse piece instead of, you know, you go back to 90s hip-hop, you might have had 3, 4, 5 verses in a song. So it's easy to just, you can chop it down, make more songs. That makes sense to me. I think where things get more complicated are when songs are using sort of more traditional verse-chorus song form. So if we look at a song like East Side, that song comes in at 2 minutes and 54 seconds, which is a pretty short pop song. Mm. And I wanted to look at just where's the extra music going. So let's take a listen to Benny Blanco's East Side, and we're going to listen to just what happens at the end.
Cool.
He used to meet me on the East Side. you should meet me on Ice Side.
He used to meet me on the east side. Okay, what did we just hear?
That I don't know.
An outro?
Outro. An
yes,
outro.
I got it.
It's an outro. But here's the thing. The material that was leading before that outro was the bridge of the song. And there's like a pretty hard and fast rule. Nate, professor, what happens after a bridge?
You go back to the chorus.
You go back to the chorus. And so what they've actually done is they've just lopped off the final chorus, instead replaced it with an outro, which is the same material as the chorus, but you don't have that sort of big final bombastic moment. Instead, it's this sort of fading out moment. It's maybe appropriate for the song since this is a melancholy looking back on a relationship song, but I think we're missing the final 30 seconds of the song because they literally just don't have the final two choruses.
Yeah, it's like a bridge that just like goes directly into the ocean.
It's a bridge to nowhere.
Yeah. So that's one sort of victim of the perhaps streaming-driven shortening of pop songs, yeah, that they're getting a chorus that you might expect to hear at the end is getting chopped off.
That's right.
And replaced by just a little outro.
Okay, so I found some other things that I think are ways that artists are adapting to make things a little thinner, a little trim. I was talking to Jeremy Lloyd of Marian Hill, who was on our show a few episodes back, and really thoughtful about composition. And one of the things he said to us was, the biggest thing I've been thinking about is skip rates to try to get people through the whole song. You all established that if you don't listen to 30 seconds of a song, mm-hmm, people, it doesn't count. Right?
That's correct.
People, if they're skipping around, it's not counting. And so how can artists game a way to hook you into the song immediately? Well, probably the most obvious thing is don't have a minute long intro. And so one sort of adaptation that I've seen is a just jump right in on the song, almost like starting the song in the middle. And so here's a clip of Kodak Black's Calling My Spirit, and just check it out. It might actually make you jump.
I put my heart on my lips. I gave it all I could give. I made it hot at the crib. I can't fight the crib. Where you gonna go when you do?
I just want to be clear. This is not me cutting into the song. The song literally just starts right here.
I put my heart on my lips. I gave it all I could give.
Huh. Interesting.
Seems like really dropped like in medias res, like I'm just in the middle of everything going on.
Don't you feel like you've like stepped in on someone's conversation? You're like, I'm so sorry.
Exactly.
I kind of loved it though. I was bouncing right from the moment it started.
Ditto. It's very effective.
That is the point. And the other adaptation that I've seen songwriters make is an old adage summarized by Dave Grohl so beautifully, talking with Kyle Grass from Tenacious D.
You know who writes the hits? Aerosmith writes the hits. The song is all chord. Love in an Elevator? What's the verse to that song? There isn't one! It's Love in an Elevator! Janie's got a gun?
Yeah.
It's all it. Well, how's it start? Janie's got a gun.
Yeah.
Right, so it's chorus, chorus, pre-chorus, chorus, verse, kinda. Chorus, pre-chorus, chorus, 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 finale, chorus. It's all chorus. Don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Don't bore us, get to the chorus.
Hit lessons.
Wow, Dave Grohl, musicologist. I like it.
So I have observed that many people are taking Dave Grohl's advice, don't bore us, get to the chorus. And rather than having a traditional intro into a verse, into a pre-chorus, into a chorus, we're just starting right in the chorus. The king of this method is Post Malone. You could look at his songs Better Now, Rockstar, Psycho, Congratulations. They all do this. Let's just take a listen to Better Now, for instance.
Probably think that you are better now, better now. You only say that cause I'm not around, not around. You know I never meant to let you down. Would've gave you anything, would've gave you...
That is the chorus. And it works. It hooks you right in immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're waiting for the next time it comes around, so you're more likely to stay now that you've got the... like the best bit of the song almost.
Exactly. And you, it's like, can I get that one again? I'm going to keep listening, get through that 30 second mark.
Can I ask you a question, Charlie? Why didn't they always do this if it's so effective?
Because maybe a pop song wants to have some romance and it wants to slowly seduce you and eventually lead you to that wonderful moment in the chorus. But now people are like, I want that dopamine hit right away. There's so many alternatives at all times, according to Spotify, right? So I'm witnessing these adaptations all over the Billboard, but the one that interests me the most is something that actually harkens to the past. And in order to uncover the most creative adaptive strategy for making music in the streaming era, I'm going to have to pass to Dr. Nate Sloan to take us back into the classical past.
Okay, so here at Switched on Pop, we like seeing music live about as much as we like talking about it. Maybe we like talking about it slightly more. I'm not sure. Anyway, so today our friends at StubHub want to know, Charlie.
Yes.
Put you in the hot seat. What was your best last-minute ticket grab?
I absolutely know the answer to this question.
Oh, okay. I'm curious.
I got to see one of the best pianists in the world last minute. A friend of mine was like, yo, do you want to go to the LA Symphony and see Yuzha Wang, who with Dudamel? And her piano playing is so stunning.
Yeah.
She did a triple, if not quadruple, encore in which she performed these sort of like themes and variations on central classical works that were clearly composed for her, because I don't think anybody else can play the works. In the show notes, it literally said that the composer of one of the pieces, like that when they started to play it, they like their hands would bleed when they first started playing this track because it was so hard to do. Anyway, she's just so talented, so much fun, and I got to sit like way up close near the front row because I got some last minute tickets that were available, and it was awesome.
That's so cool. Yes. StubHub is here to help you make your own last minute musical memories, or any kind of musical memories, because you can get tickets to any genre, any artist, anytime, and explore your live style with StubHub. Go to StubHub.com/pop to find your next concert ticket.
This episode is sponsored by On Dash, the shoe company revolutionizing your run with high-tech soles that'll make your feet feel like they're floating in zero gravity. And On running shoes look great with minimal design and a sleek profile. You'll want to wear them all day, every day. On is giving you 30 days to test out any of their shoes and running clothes. Take them for a spin, get them dirty, and if you don't love them, you can send them back. Head to on-running.com/pop to get yours today. That's on-running.com/pop.
That's my cue. So we're going to talk about something we're calling the pop overture. And that the second half of that phrase, the overture, is like the classical part of this conversation, because overtures go back to the world of opera. If you think of a Rossini opera like William Tell, that starts with just an instrumental overture, including the famous theme. But those overtures are not exactly what we're talking about, because those overtures don't really feature like music from the opera that you're going to see.
What's the point of them? What are they doing?
Those are really to just engage the audience and to get them pumped up for the show that they're about to see. That's pretty much it. It's like going to a stadium and they play,
We Will Rock You.
Exactly. Yeah. But then what we're more interested in what you might call like the Broadway overture, because this is an approach to writing an overture where you do the same thing. You get the audience excited, you get them jazzed up, but you do it by taking all this music from the show they're about to see and putting it into like a compact little medley. You can take the example of a show like West Side Story. That multi-hour musical gets condensed down into like a 5-minute medley. We can play just a few excerpts from it right now. So we go from the song Tonight, Tonight to Maria, Maria. And then to the climactic, it's called Mambo, but it's like the big fight scene in the rumble scene, kind of. So you're getting like all the material from the show you're about to see, and it's kind of getting you excited, amping you up for the spectacle that you're about to behold.
It's spoiler alert.
Yeah, in a way, I guess it is. Yeah.
That's the classical pass. And I'm hearing basically artists taking this classical idea of the overture, probably not intentionally, but with the same effect, trying to get you excited for what's to come right away, right when you sit down in your seat or wherever you are listening in your car. Song comes on and you're in it. And the way that they're doing that is they're taking a fragment of the most exciting part of the song, the chorus, and they're putting it into the beginning of the song. And there's a couple of different ways that I've heard people try this pop overture. Let's start with Dua Lipa. Her song, One Kiss, begins with a pop overture.
One kiss is all it takes, falling in love with me. Possibilities, I look like all you need.
We can hear how that intro comes again later. Here's the chorus in full.
'Cause I'm lost in the way you move, the way you feel. Kiss is all it takes, falling in love with me. Possibilities, I look like all you need. One kiss is all it takes.
And so you get the full version. Here what she's done is she's sort of applied a filter effect at the intro and given you just a small section of the chorus. Not the whole thing, a little fragment of it. Now, the next artist that I hear doing this is Drake. We're going to talk more about Drake because Drake is really important in the streaming economy. On his song, God's Plan, we are getting that same sort of fragment approach, and maybe even a smaller amount of the chorus.
They wish and I wish and I wish and I wish and they wishing on me. Yeah.
That's the intro. Simple. Not much. You know, if you, just to remind everyone, if you haven't heard it, I think it's been streamed 2 billion times, but here it is.
Bad things, it's a lot of bad things that they wishing and wishing and wishing and wishing they wishing on me.
Little fragment of the chorus at the very beginning. I have one more clip that I want to play you all, which is Ariana Grande. And she takes this to the extreme. She's going to take the pop overture, take that little chorus bit in the intro, and obfuscate it so that you don't even know what you're hearing until you hear it later. This is her song, NASA. So we just get a 4 count of this kind of like strange synthesizer in the background,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But check out what happens in the chorus. Hey, what do you think we're hearing?
Oh, okay, so
are you catching it?
I think you're saying that the pop, that synthesized line we hear at the, what we're calling the pop overture at the beginning of the song, is the same melody that she's singing later when the chorus comes in.
I think it is. That sounds like it to me.
I agree it's the melody. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's not actually a sample of her voice that has been distorted and filtered. Check it out one more time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a good hypothesis, Chuck.
It's introductory material that you have no idea is particularly important. Like, even her song Break Free with Zed begins with some really wild and interesting synthesizers that don't come back again until much later into the outro. They don't really have a relationship to the rest of the song. And that's not uncommon. Sometimes introductory and outro material is something unique to bring you in and take you out of the song. And here, this is like, I'm going to give you the prize at the end, but it's just a hint of it. Like, maybe you're seeing it from afar.
So is the idea kind of like, if you're listening to a playlist, that you get the song, like a taste of the song in the very beginning, and then you can just immediately decide, oh, I'm going to stick with this long enough to, you know, get that 30 seconds payout.
Yeah.
Or if it's not, or you're like, oh, no, I didn't like that little, that 3 second intro, so I'm going to skip to the next one.
That's what I'm thinking.
I find it persuasive.
What do you all think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting reminder of what you're going to get. So you might stick with the song a bit longer. You get the juices flowing right away in a way that you're sort of not suspecting, and then the full thing comes on later.
Yeah, I like this idea of foreshadowing, almost, is what it seems like to me.
Yeah, that's good.
And you're just sort of getting a little taste, and it's the way it is in books, right? You see something, you're like, ooh, I like that. And then later you're like, oh my God, that's what it was. I like it even more.
You know, to your point, I'm actually starting to listen differently now. Because, like, I don't know, I feel like so often introductory material, it feels more throwaway in a lot of popular music, or like it has, at least my relationship to it has been as such. And now I'm like, ooh, what is that thing you just did? Is that going to come back later?
The recycling approach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So one of the concerns that Mark Ronson brings up is this question of, like, is the streaming economy incentives fundamentally changing how music is written? And I think there's an important inverse of that question is the way that music is written actually just making shorter songs? It's hard to know which variable is accounting for this effect. And in your article, you talked about the rise of beat-making culture as a way of producing music that may also be contributing to this. What is beat-making culture?
So beat-making culture is basically when you make a funky beat and then you license that out to other artists or producers and they can sample it. And this is from Jeff Ponchik from Repost. When I spoke to him, and that's a platform that sort of connects artists to streaming platforms. And the idea is once you get a really good beat and you find that it's lucrative and it's successful, that the greatest incentive is just to license it out and then create another one. So it's kind of like you're producing as quick as possible because you know that this beat is good, so you want to make the next one as quickly as possible.
So it's kind of like an assembly line approach to pop production or something.
In a way. And obviously, streaming incentives have sort of heightened the tension between, you know, artistic integrity and creating beats that are optimal for streaming. But I do think there is more incentive to create things quicker. And I think Mark Ronson touched on that too. He talked about how people just write songs in 30 minutes. And in that Guardian interview, he said, well, it sounds like you wrote it in 30 minutes. But often with beats, I don't think that's necessarily as obvious in comparison to lyrics.
I think this gets to the important idea that it's beats mostly that they're making rather than writing more, you know, songs that include bridges and multiple melodies and things like that. And so I think when you have songs that are based on just this one particular beat, it doesn't make sense for those songs to be quite as long if there's not as much variation.
Especially if people are having fun listening to them. Why totally. Why extend them if it's working? I think this raises a really important question, and sort of to get to the underlying anxiety is, I think Aisha, you mentioned artistic integrity, and this is very real. I think people are concerned, are there bad players out there? Is there fraud? Are people cheating this new system?
There are people who have been trying to cheat the streaming system, as you say. So one sort of high-profile case was this band called Vulpec.
Yeah.
And what they did was that they created this silent album. And they encouraged their fans to sort of play this album on repeat as they slept over and over again.
I believe it was called Sleepify.
Exactly, yeah. Sleepify. And then they said to their fans that the money generated from those streams would be used to fund their next tour.
Huh.
So in a way, you know, I don't know if the impetus behind that was sinister or not, but either way, they were totally cheating the system.
Yeah, there was another scam in Bulgaria that was not, you know, I don't think there were any good reasons for it, like the Vulpec one. They made about $1 million, this group of people in Bulgaria who just created fake Spotify accounts and played a third-party playlist over and over and over. And yeah, $1 million out of it. Pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah. Just to jump in on that, that's sort of on the production side or the artist side. There have also been cases where fans have been cheating the system, right? And I think the most high profile of these cases is Harry Styles and then BTS fans. And for those who don't know, BTS, which is short for the Bangtan Boys, is this really popular K-pop group. And their fans sort of systematically bought US premium accounts and distributed those login details all across the world and convinced other fans to sort of stream over and over and over again. They even used VPNs to, like, sort of trick the servers. And that made it seem like, you know, the songs were skyrocketing to the top of the charts. Right. And now it's really hard to know what was fraud and what was real.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with the ARMY. That's the name of the BTS fans.
Yes, the BTS ARMY.
That's wild. I, unlike Mark Ronson, though, I definitely empathize as a fellow neurotic Jew in general about his you know anxieties about the state of the world. This particular thing, the how streaming is changing the sound of music, doesn't keep me up at night, because I think, as we've talked about, this is maybe part of a cyclical aspect of the music industry, right? You know, albums have not been around that long. They're a relatively new phenomenon. They've only been around since the 60s.
1948 was the LP.
Oh, no, Charlie, but that wasn't an album.
The LP, okay, this is really interesting. So the LP was invented in 1948, but album-oriented music only took off in the late 60s when people sort of finally took advantage of that extra length. Similarly, Spotify came out in 2006, the most dominant mm-hmm. streaming platform. And now we're talking, mm-hmm. 14 years later, 13 years later, people are now responding to this new medium. And there's sort of this lag time between these new technologies gaining dominance within the industry.
Mm, yeah, I see what you
but
mean.
To your point, yeah, things have always fluctuated. I mean, for example, Dan, you were mentioning earlier that songs used to be a lot shorter. When I saw all of these concerns about song lengths, I went to absurd lengths to build a database of all the number one songs since they've been documented. I think since 1937 was the earliest I could go back. And songs used to be about 3 minutes long back in the 30s and 40s. But half of that song was often an instrumental. So if you took a song like All the Things You Are by Tommy Dorsey, the 1940 recording.
You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long.
There is just 1 minute and 6 seconds of lyrics in a 3 minute and 19 second song. The rest is instrumental that basically does the same melody as the lyric with maybe a little intro and outro. And so I don't think anyone's questioning, is All the Things You Are, is it a good song, bad song because of its length? It's almost a ridiculous question. If you walked into a gallery and you're like, man, canvas sizes are getting really small, or they're getting really big. It's like, is that really that indicative of what's happening within the frame?
Yeah. In my opinion, the best album of 2018 was Tierra Whack's Whack World.
Whack World.
Oh, yeah.
Diamonds in my pearl. I said, thank you, I designed it. Not your average girl.
For those who don't know, Tierra Whack's debut album, Whack World, was made up of 15 songs that were 1 minute or less. And 1 minute is also the maximum length of an Instagram video. And each song had an accompanying video. So I see that album as sort of this example of playing around and manipulating with these confines of like the shorter song and creating, in your words, like a smaller canvas and maybe just putting more in it, which I think is interesting.
It felt almost like a commentary on the song. This is like a commentary on the song form, because when I listened to it, every single time it got to the minute mark, I was like, oh, I want more of it, which is actually really effective, because you're like, I gotta go back and listen again.
Exactly. It's a really good tactic. But just to your previous point about how, songs have always been shorter, but now there is this sort of anxiety. I think that anxiety is tied to like brevity in popular culture or digital platforms as a whole. People are concerned about, light culture, where we just respond to everything with a thumbs up or just an emoji. And we're just like scrolling through Instagram videos or Snapchat videos kind of numbly. And I think this anxiety over shorter songs, or maybe the diminishing quality of music because of shorter songs, is actually tied to maybe the diminishing quality of our communication or interaction with each other because of the way that social media has pervaded, like, society.
It is the deep existential angst working its way in.
I think that's, Aisha, I think that's, if I can be so bold, I think that's a great place to end this conversation. Because to me, like, what this, your expertise and like, bringing in both some audio examples and some facts about this have made me realize, like, oh, you can't, like, you ultimately can't cheat the system. Like, you can't trick someone into listening to a song. Like, people are only going to listen to music if they like it, and they're not if they don't. So it's not like music isn't getting any better or worse as a result of this, but the way we feel about it says a lot about what we're scared of in general, right?
I think so.
Totally.
Wow. You all have brought so much thought into this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been so much fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You can go check out Aisha and Dan's piece, The Reason Why Your Favorite Pop Songs Are Getting Shorter, on Quartz, and we'll put it in our show notes. I want to say thanks to Jeremy Lloyd from Marian Hill, Chris Melanfi from Slate. Go check out his show, Hit Parade. It's great. And I want to say a special thanks to Courtney Leonard, Crystal Stevens, and Georgia Cowley for making Switched On Pop look great. You might not have noticed, but we got a little bit of a makeover, and the design team from Vox, I think, has just done a stunning job. So thank you so much. Switched On Pop is a production of Vox Media, executive production by Nishat Kurwa and Allison Rocky, production by Jillian Weinberger, engineering by Brandon McFarland, community manager Sarah Terry.
You can find more shows on any podcast you player you use, Apple Podcast app, Spotify, so on, so forth. I'm thinking now, though, Charlie, all our shows should be kept to about three. 30. Yeah, maybe just like two minutes and 50 seconds.
Yeah,
or so.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's try that. That'd be
okay,
fun.
Great.
You can find more episodes as well on switchedonpop.com, and we love getting your suggestions on Twitter and Instagram. We are at switchedonpop. We are going to be back again in another week, so we will see you next Tuesday. And until then,
thanks for listening. This episode of Switched on Pop was brought to you by StubHub. With tickets to more than 10 million live events worldwide, StubHub is the world's largest ticket marketplace. Whether you want to see your favorite artists of all time or new up-and-comer, you can find tickets to any genre, any artist, anytime on StubHub. Because going to concerts is more than just entertainment. It's a lifestyle. Go to StubHub.com/pop to find your next concert ticket.